Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart, welcoming you here for a special discussion with the lead partners at New Harbor Financial. That's one of the endorsed financial advisory firms by Wealthion. They join me on this channel every week, usually following the interview of an august guest that we've just had on the program. We've had so much new content produced recently that I wanted to get the guys on to basically go through their reactions to a bunch of the experts we've recently had on this channel. But before we do that, I wanted to dig in with them to yesterday's FOMC press conference and the statements that Fed Chair Jerome Powell made afterwards. Anyways, John and Mike, guys, thanks so much for joining us here. So, the world waits with bated breath now to hear the Fed whenever the Fed has one of these meetings, for better or worse. I think we both think worse. The policy decisions are still driving the action in the world. I know we yearn for a day where we can just talk about what the fundamentals might dictate that investments will do. But right now, everything is basically getting driven around by what the Fed and the other central banks decide to do. So anyways, we had this new Fed meeting this week. Jerome Powell came out yesterday for the conference. I got to say, I actually think that Jerome Powell did a pretty good job given the very tight spot that the Fed is in. And let me preface all this by saying that I personally think the Fed should pause. In fact, I think it should have paused a while ago. To wait and see the impact of the lag effects of all the aggressive tightening and rate hikes that it's done over the past year. But I didn't think they were going to, given guidance that Jerome Powell had given. And as we've all said, that the Fed is sort of playing for its credibility here. But I felt like he did, he said the things that he needed to say. I mean, one, he reiterated many times that the Fed's priority is still bringing inflation under control. He is still guiding to a 2%. Inflation, we can talk about whether we think the Fed will actually be successful in that, but some people have been saying that the Fed was going to maybe begin to walk back its inflation targeting and maybe start raising it, maybe up towards 3%. Powell is not giving any indication he's willing to do that yet. While they did raise the Fed funds rate by another 25 basis points, Powell did say that the Fed was going to be much more data dependent going forward, and he didn't commit to doing another rate hike at the next meeting. He basically said that the Fed was already kind of trying to wind down its hikes, and that given the recent fears about the banking system, the Fed is seeing that banks are going to be tightening their lending conditions even further based upon those concerns. And that tightening of lending conditions is actually going to act like additional Fed rate hikes. And he doesn't know exactly what the magnitude of that's going to be, but essentially what he implied is that we're going to be getting more than 25 basis points worth of tightening out of the environment now, because the Fed is doing 25 itself, but then you're going to have the additional impact of these tightening lending standards. So, he's basically saying, we're going to monitor and assess. So rather than committing to yet another rate hike, he said, we're going to wait up until next week's meet or next Fed meeting. And then we're only going to decide then whether another hike is merited or not. When asked if he was going to start cutting rates, he said, nope, not in our plan at all. It's not in our base case. The market, during the presser, one of the reporters asked, hey, the market is basically pricing Fed rate cuts starting in summer for the rest of the year. What do you have to say about that, Powell? And he just said, well, that's what the market thinks. That's not what my plan is. So if he is really trying to wring optimism for a Fed put out of the market, that is the message he's got to tell. The other thing I think he did well, too, is handled the questions about the banking system, where he basically said, look, banking system sound. Nobody should worry. Of course, that's his job to say that. But he basically said, look, we will guarantee that depositors shouldn't have to worry about their deposits. And so, if other things start breaking in the banking system, you can believe we'll step in with swift emergency measures like we just did for Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. He was pressed as to whether he was guaranteeing now all deposits, insured and uninsured, at all U.S. banks. He played coy there, but he basically just sort of said, hey, look, we're going to do whatever it takes. So, his job is to make sure that depositors feel that their funds are safe enough in the banking system, you know, that they're not running in fear to potentially create additional bank runs running through the system. All right, so guys, I'll take a pause here. That was my interpretation of it. John, what did you think?
Yeah, hello, Adam, and hello, everybody again. I think you got a good coverage of the events of the day. They were quite volatile in terms of the way the markets traded. And one big reason for that was the seeming complete disconnect between Jerome Powell, the Fed chair, and Janet Yellen, the current Treasury Secretary. I'll do us a favor and pull up a chart of the S&P just to kind of show you how it played out minute by minute yesterday. All right, so this is the S&P 500. It spiked up in response to Powell's, the announcement in the press conference right here. Shortly thereafter, Janet Yellen came out and basically said, "Oh, we've made no promises about a broad-based guarantee of uninsured deposits across the board for every bank out there." And the market, I think that was one of the key reasons the market sold off really hard into the close yesterday. It was down pretty good on the day. This is the trajectory so far today. Actually, interestingly enough, Janet Yellen came out today and kind of reversed her reversal, because 2 or 3 days ago, the tone was we're gonna protect the deposits. Yesterday, she came back seemingly to walk that back. And then today she's out again, seemingly reversing her reversal. So it's a little bit of a clown show, I guess, from the communication and messaging standpoint, not only with respect to Jay Powell and Janet Yellen being on the same page, but just the quick reversals. Obviously there's a lot of unsettled action that perhaps is confounding the messaging that they're trying to put out there. One other kind of quick observation in Jay Powell's press conference yesterday was he was asked directly at one point, how in the loop were you and your colleagues at the Fed with the uptick in examinations of a Silicon Valley Bank, I believe was specifically the question. And he stammered pretty noticeably and as if to say that we weren't really in the loop. And he basically said, "I got to get back to you on that." It was really uninspiring. Certainly didn't instill a lot of confidence that they were, very much in the loop with what was going on with the banking situation. So,
yeah, he made some comments about, "Hey, you can be sure, that we are going to get to the bottom of what happened." But he made a comment that basically was sort of like, this hit us out of the blue the same way it hit everybody, which sort of raised the question of, all right, but you guys are in charge of oversight, right? how big of a failure of oversight was this? And he was understandably, I think unwilling to say, "Hey, we really screwed up here." He just said, "Oh, well, we'll look into it and get back to you." But to your point there, John, it didn't inspire confidence that they seemed to really get caught flat-footed by this. All he really said is look, if we get caught flat-footed again by other surprise blowups, you can be sure that we're going to step in aggressively the way that we did. It is so interesting though, because everything around the banking system revolves around confidence, and it doesn't inspire confidence when you've got these sort of mixed messages that are being put out there by basically the two big players in the space right now, Jerome Powell, head of the Fed, and Janet Yellen, head of the Treasury. So you use the term clown show. It is a little bit of one right now from a coordination standpoint. And that's definitely not what you want to see, when you're trying to, calm the system down, is where people at the top don't seem to be talking from the same script. Mike, you have anything else to add to what John observed?
Not really. I think you both covered it very well. It's a little bit of a sad fact that we're reduced to, disseminating every little word that the Fed and the related people say. But it's clear that it's clear that there's some nervousness about the system that they've created, or the system that they've pushed to this extreme. And I don't think that Silicon Valley Bank and the other banks that you mentioned are going to be the end of the story. There's never just one problem, never just one cockroach, so to speak. And it really is the result of a system pushed this far for this long, we'll see what happens. But, the Fed talked about inflation, they remain committed to 2% inflation. We'll see. Powell's trying to talk a tough game and saying he's committed, but we were at zero for years on inflation, and then we shot right to 9%. What, I don't know why we think that they can fine tune this like this with this many variables stretched to the limit in the system, all amidst a moment of hyper overvaluation in all of the markets, a stock market that absolutely has to be supported by the Fed and managed, or else the whole system really suffers. So a lot of game theorizing going on here, but the big picture is that the markets are at a critical juncture. They remain hyper overvalued, and technically they've been looking weak. We just had a 70-point reversal in the S&P from high to low. As we speak here on Thursday, the market was really strong, gapped up the other day, but it's been having trouble really making progress and pushing through to the upside. So, you know, amidst daily moves of 50 S&P points almost every day and in opposite directions, the market seems very undecided and is technically in a dangerous spot. So we'll see what happens next. You know, the, as John pointed out, we had a big up move, then a big down move, then a big up move today. And we had just turned red a minute ago. Maybe we're up a little bit now, but we'll see. The waters are getting more choppy and more turbulent. So this certainly seems dangerous.
All right. Well, look, one of the things that Powell didn't talk about this time around that he's actually talked a lot about at the previous press conference was the lag effect. You know, Powell, I think prudently was telling people, hey, you know, there's a lag effect to our policy, and that's why we're going to pause at some point, right? Because we want to give that policy, the repercussions of those policies, those rate hikes that we've made in the past, to catch up to us, to see if they're enough to bring inflation under control or if we're going to need more. As we've been talking about a lot on this channel, you know, there's a danger that the Fed may have actually already over-tightened, right? That we have maybe done too much in terms of rate hikes, and then with the additional quantitative tightening going on, that as those waves of the impact of previous rate hikes begin to really hit, that we may find out that the Fed did too much, but it's too late to do anything about it because you have these shockwaves traveling through time and continuing to sort of slam into the economy here. Interestingly, Powell didn't talk about them all that much, which, you know, I feel is maybe an error, because as we've talked about recently on this channel again, you know, it's just recently that we're really feeling the impacts of the first rate hikes that were done back in March of last year. And those are already causing the weaker players like Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank to topple here, right? So you take that backlog of the lag effect that's headed our way, and then you add to that those additional tightening of credit standards that Powell was talking about. And in his words, you know, he said those substitute for rate hikes. That's why he's unwilling to commit to doing another rate hike yet, because essentially the tightening of the lending standards is doing that for the Fed. So assuming that we've over-tightened in the past, if we have, well, the Fed has just tightened again this time around. And then the banks are tightening conditions even further. So, you know, basically we could be making a bad situation worse. That's sort of my whole premise for why I think the Fed probably should have paused before, you know, not just now, but probably a few meetings ago. You know, the reason why I think it's important to note that Powell didn't talk about it is, I mean, I do feel like he needs to be talking tough about what's, you know, he quarters ago, he was kind of presaging all of this by saying, hey, look, we're going to get inflation under control, but it's going to cause some pain, and households and businesses are going to have to kind of prep for that. He hasn't used that language very much recently, but I think we're now at the point where that pain is starting to arrive, and I think it's going to get worse for all the reasons that I just mentioned. So, you know, I really feel that you know, it's beholden on him to make sure that the American public kind of knows what's coming so that they can prepare for it and not just get caught blindsided by it. And secondly, you know, he needs to talk tough about exactly this, because he wants to break the confidence in the Fed put and basically let folks know, hey, I'm aware this is coming. I've played a role in creating it. And, you know, as long as inflation stays above where we need it to be, we're going to let you know, this stuff do its damage. And we're not going to ride to the rescue the way that the markets, you know, are still pricing in at this point in time. So back to you, John, for a second. I mean, how important is this omission from of the lag effect from Powell's recent remarks? How significant is that, do you think?
Yeah, I really hadn't pondered that too deeply, Adam, but I think it is a notable thing that you point out. You know, I just got to kind of inject some broader perspective here, and I know you feel this way too, but, you know, we're focusing on the, have they gone too far in the tightening, you know, really speaks to the bigger and much earlier policy error of letting the easy money take root for so long, you know. So
absolutely, so
the error was long in the making on being so easy for so long, and it's almost like the consequence of that is you got to swing, probably, you know, erring on the side of being too hard in the other direction. It's an unfortunate you know, beehive that has been made here, but it's of their own making, and you could pin all kinds of bad behavior and imprudent decisions on not just the Fed, but actors in the economy. This banking crisis, you know, in some ways these banks were told by the Fed, hey, we're not raising rates anytime soon. This inflation is transitory. Trust us, you know, we're going to stay easy for long. And they bought securities on that. You know, I'm not giving anybody a free pass here, but there were a lot of compounding issues that the easy money policy that was been in place for far too long are now kind of, you know, the leftovers are no good choices or different degrees of bad choices. And one of those is probably having to err too much than they otherwise would have liked to on being hardline on tightening the standards or the monetary policy, because they know the consequences. They don't get a do-over here. It's really important to make sure that they don't lose credibility further on that front.
Yeah, well, very well said. Mike, anything to wrap up on the Fed before we move on to some of the other topics here?
I really don't have anything else to add to that. I think you guys covered it pretty well.
Okay. All right. Well, look, you know, we'll be watching the markets very closely from here. Obviously, the impact of all the things that you know, John and I just mentioned, but you know, as these lag effects continue to slam into the economy and the financial markets, we would expect that, you know, that will push the economy further towards recession. And at some point, stocks are going to get the memo. Mike, you were just talking about how turbulent markets are right now. You know, maybe they're beginning to process some of this. One of the elements of the response to both the banking system crisis, or at least the banking system worries that we've had, and the recent remarks by the Fed, is that the precious metals have responded very well over the past 2 weeks, and they you know, took a recent jump following Chair Powell's comments the other day. So I do want to spend just a couple of minutes talking about them, because that's a good segue then into the next experts' commentary that I want to talk with you guys, which was the Fred Hickey interview that we did earlier this week, because Fred is a great macro analyst and his bread and butter is around the tech industry. But he delivered one of the most emphatic arguments for investing in the precious metals right now and the mining stocks that I've heard in a long time. So I do want to deconstruct that with you guys. But real quickly, let's just start with your thoughts on how the precious metals are reacting and maybe why they're reacting the way they're doing. Mike, why don't we stay with you on this?
Yeah, the gold is it's been pretty whippy, but it's doing wonderfully today on Thursday. We are at 1999.9 as we close here, close to 4 o'clock Eastern on the stock market. Anyway, I know that the metals market in Chicago closes, I think, at 2:30, but and I think I will try to bring up this chart. And we know we talked about it during the seminar last weekend, but it's a really nice looking chart. So, and it's a lot easier to understand when you take a look at it. But here's a daily chart of gold futures. And so this chart is going back about a year or so, but this is a big base and a very messy looking handle. But, you know, we've had a lot of big up days here. And look at this print. I don't know if you could see that on your screen because it's small. But we just closed at 2,000 on the front month futures. If I go out a little bit to, let's say, the weekly chart, you'll see here this previous consolidation point. This breakdown, which was pretty disappointing, I should say there was actually a breakout. It looked like it was going to go above 2,000 back in March of last year, a full year ago, and then all of this disappointing movement down. It has very swiftly come up and regained this important point of 1820, the apex of this old triangle, came back and tested that, and then boom, here we are back testing the 2,000 level, closing above it today, just barely, but we're there. On the monthly chart, this is really the best looking chart of all, one of the biggest bases I've ever seen, a big, big cup and handle formation. Yes, there were some breakouts and fakeouts, but if we really can push higher and stay above 2,000, I think it's clear sailing right to 2,500. And this has really been an underappreciated move. There's not a lot of talking about it. So, and the miners should do well too. They're lagging a little bit. If we look at GDX, just as an example, they are lagging a little bit. They had their own triangle and the same breakout and then breakdown move, but they're having a pretty good day, up about 2.5%. If gold can stay above 2,000, we should see GDX and other miners move right up towards 40 and then ultimately higher, playing some catch up. So overall, it's a really, really strong picture, I think, for gold. It's taken a lot of faith to hold through all of these moves, both for gold and gold miners. But technically, it looks really good. We remain in the position. We recommend that people own 5 or 10% of actual bullion physically. But in our portfolio, we own 10% mining shares. And we did just reset our hedge on some strength earlier this week. We have a call around part of the position, about half of the position, where we sold call options up at 37, going out 1 month to the end of April, or the third Friday in April. And we use that premium to buy puts down at 27. So we've got a lot of upside here. We only have half of our position collared, and we wouldn't be surprised to see a rapid move here once gold, if gold stays above 2,000, we could see some real fast moves in gold mining shares. So yeah, we'll watch and wait.
All right. Well, this sounds exciting. I mean, I know that you guys have been waiting for gold to kind of find its mojo back. And I know it's early, but is this the, are you seeing the indicators of what you were looking for here in this recent, you know, swift upward reaction in gold, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, it's just from pure technicals, you know, from pure, the technicals look good. It's better because we don't hear a lot of people talking about gold. The sentiment still seems pretty neutral. Again, today was the first close above 2,000 I've seen in a long time. We haven't seen a dollar collapse. The dollar's been a little bit soft, but gold seems to have decoupled at least short term from the U.S. dollar, which is a good sign. And yeah, we'll see what happens in the S&P. As I've said before, the S&P has some real, in my opinion, sudden downside risk. The big question is, will miners be dragged down by the market if the market tanks? We're worried about that too, which is why we keep resetting our collars. It's possible that gold can, you know, particularly if there's more concerns about the banks or other things structurally in the economy, it's possible that gold could take off even as the S&P is tanking. And under that situation, I think the gold miners probably would not follow the market down. So we don't want to be really cute about it and be out of the miners saying that we're worried about the S&P. We choose to keep the position on and manage it the best we can with our hedges to take care of any downside surprises in the market.
Yeah, well, what I like about that approach, and we've talked about this many, many times in the channel because you use this approach for a number of other assets in your portfolio, but is, you know, if you're worried about a big market drawdown and the asset class that you like and think has a good long-term outlook, kind of getting dragged down in the near term with that, that's where the hedges really come into play well, right? So you can stay in your position. Because no one knows what's going to happen. And as you said, you know, the market may go down and the miners may go up. We just don't know, right? So you don't necessarily want to be out of the position, because then if the market moves against you, you're then, you know, stuck trying to chase it and you know, waiting for some sort of entry point that may not avail itself. Whereas if you take the position, but you hedge it to the downside, you can limit the downside pain you take if indeed there's that big drawdown, but you're still in the position so that when the market recovers, you know, you're still in it, you're riding it back up, you've limited your downside loss to it. And as we've had a number of experts on this channel enumerate for us recently, you know, the magic is getting a dependable positive return, you know, year after year after year, so that compounding can work its effect. And, you know, what throws a big monkey wrench in that is the years where you have really big drawdowns. Well, if you can avoid those really big drawdowns by paying the insurance to hedge, yeah, maybe you limit some of your upside, but your odds of getting that steady, you know, positive gain after positive gain after positive gain, you know, really ramp up, and you can really let the magic of compounding work for you. John, let me just come over to you real quick. So I mentioned that we had Fred Hickey on the channel the other day, and you know, he gave that really gold positive exposition, and then even shared, you know, some of his favorite gold mining stocks with us and folks. I won't say what they are, so that you, if you're interested, you can go and actually watch the video itself. It's definitely worth watching. If you haven't seen it yet, I'll put up a link to it right here. But John, I'm curious, on top of Mike's, you know, technical argument there for gold and the miners doing well from here, I'd love for you to opine on either Fred's or yours more sort of fundamental reasons, particularly as the Fed, you know, is kind of saying, hey, we might not be doing that many more rate hikes. And therefore, that in and of itself is probably quite positive for gold, that real interest rates are probably going to start coming back down again.
Yeah, so a couple of things. So Fred talked about, and we've oftentimes observed and commented that even at current gold prices, the valuation of the gold mining stocks relative to the price of the metal is at very low levels relative to its historical norms. Fred kind of threw out some statistics of the Huey, H-U-I, Gold Bugs Index relative to gold itself. You know, currently he said it's at 0.122, whereas in the 2000s it averaged more like 0.46, so almost, you know, a four times under its traditional, you know, or its kind of typical range. That quick takeaway is that the gold mining stocks could rally very substantially, even with gold prices staying where they are, not going up at all any further from here, and still, you know, not even get to their historical ranges. You know, in fact, I want to pull up another chart here just to kind of look at, you know, in a shorter term fashion, some of the relationship between gold and the gold miners. So let me do that right now. I'm just going to share my screen. And so this is a chart. Mike had pulled up the chart of GDX, the gold miners. That's where these bars are. And this is a weekly chart. So each one of these bars is a week. The fuchsia here, if I got the color correct here, is actually GLD. So a metric for bullion. And you see the last time GLD was up here in the, you know, 180, low 180s, the gold miners were in the low 40s, right? Here we are again, back at that level. Gold miner, you know, GDX is a proxy for the gold miners, only in the low 30s. Again, back here in late 2020, I guess it was, you know, gold was up around these levels, and the gold miners were in the mid 40s. So on a relative basis, the gold miners are lagging. We think have every likelihood of catching up to the price of metal itself, just on this chart. But you know, from a longer term standpoint, they are very undervalued relative to the price of metal. It's like saying energy stocks are under, you know, haven't rallied with oil, or the price of oil. And usually that's a very tight relationship. Should be very similar to here. Now, there are a number of factors that play into this, like the input costs that go into the mining of the metal and things like that. And actually, Fred shared some useful statistics. He you know, threw some numbers from like fourth quarter of last year, where the average sustaining cost for the mining complex was something like $1,230 an ounce, meaning if the price of gold is above that on average, the sector is making money, right? And at the time, gold was at like $1,730. So there's about $500 per ounce margin in the kind of spread between the break even and where gold prices were. And here we are at, you know, gold touching 2000 today. And, you know, the miners have not fully rallied. So plenty of catch up that we think can happen there. Taking a bigger zoom out fundamentally, this is a sector that has cyclically over the years gone through bouts of complete carelessness in the way they run their balance sheets and their business, you know, loading on debt and speculating with new mines and things like that. And there have been times where the sector has done that and rightfully got punished. But the last several years, they have dramatically cleaned up their balance sheets. These are companies that are generating very attractive free cash flow, you know, very attractive debt to EBITDA ratios. All to say that if you forget what these companies do for a moment and just compare them to the average, you know, stock in the S&P 500, these look like really well-run companies, profitable companies. And, you know, you throw in the fact that there hasn't been a whole lot of investment in new production. You know, you have the recipe for a supply constrained environment like many natural resources, which should provide a tailwind to not only the commodities themselves, but the companies that produce them. And we'll likely see investment coming back into this sector as those supply constraints are looked to be alleviated. So, you know, there's both short-term and bigger picture long-term reasons that we think the gold miners should do very well. But we do have edges in place, as Mike talked about, because the near-term picture can be volatile and can shake folks out and maybe get them a little worried on a short-term basis. So but long-term, we think it's a very, very sound-looking sector.
All right. Very well said, John. And you were reminding me of something that I mentioned to folks at this past weekend's conference that I'll bring up here for the general audience, which is, you know, it is a really interesting time in the space. There's a lot of experts that are highly experienced in investing in the space over decades, guys like Rick Rule, Tavi Costa, John Hathaway, you know, who are saying, hey, the planets are aligning right now in ways that make them more excited about this space than they've been in a long time. And a big reason is, you know, what you mentioned there, John, is sort of the fundamental factors are aligning, but it's at the same time that many of the companies have been forced to kind of clean up their act, right? Where they were poorly run companies, or they were getting away with all sorts of share dilution, or, you know, management taking out more money than it should, all that type of stuff. So the industry has been really cleaned up and tightened in a good way. And now, as you said, you know, it's poised potentially for a lot of capital to start flowing in. So the returns could be juiced even further by the companies just being run a lot more efficiently than they've been in the past. So the challenge, the opportunity, there's a lot of opportunity here. The challenge, obviously, is there's a ton of these companies in the mining space, especially the smaller ones, that are not going to make any money, right? You know, mining's hard. It's just like oil prospecting. Not every, you know, drill finds oil. And not every company is run well, even if it has good underlying projects on it. So this challenge of sort of, you know, separating the wheat from the chaff, right? How do we find good quality companies to invest in? A big way to do that is to follow somebody who follows the space well, and probably nobody does this better than a Rick Rule. And just a reminder for folks, we're going to talk about this in a minute, but at the conference this past week, Rick shared like over 30 specific stocks that are on his current portfolio that he thinks very favorably of right now. And a good chunk of those were precious metals mining stocks. So you want to follow somebody like that who's super experienced in the industry, you know, talks to management. You know, in past days, Rick would go out and actually tour the mines, et cetera. And then there are other folks who have their newsletters that do this. And as I mentioned, Fred Hickey had shared a couple of good picks too. But one thing that we are thinking about doing here at Wealthion, and this is the temperature check I want to do with you, the viewers, is we're increasingly getting contacted by companies in the space saying, hey, we've got a good story to tell. We want to get our story out there to people that are interested in potentially investing in hard assets, you know, specifically in this case, a lot of them are precious metals mining companies. And we at Wealthion have relationships with people that have been in the space for many years. Some names I've already mentioned. Who are serving as sort of an advisory board for filtering out for us, okay, these are the companies to take seriously. These are the ones, you know, that don't pass their quality threshold. And for those that do, we're thinking about putting together a new series here on Wealthion, in addition to these, you know, regular daily videos that we publish, where we sit down with the CEOs of these promising companies and, you know, really hammer things out with them, you know, crawl into their brains, get a sense for their macro views, their understanding of the precious metal space, and then give them the opportunity to talk about what they're doing with their specific company and what distinguishes it from all the other companies in the space. If there's interest on your end as the viewers here of Wealthion for these type of deep dive interviews with key CEOs in this space, let us know, because if there is enough interest, we will start this new series. And the vision that we're kind of cobbling together right now is it's not going to be unique and limited to the precious metals space. You know, we'll end up doing it for other spaces, energy, uranium, other types of hard assets. And who knows where it could go from there. But it's really to kind of climb in the minds of the folks that are the key operators, the key entrepreneurs, the key business people, to get a look through their eyes and then understand the specific, you know, unique value that they're trying to create with their companies. Again, if there's interest in that, let me know in the comments section below. If there is, we'll start doing that. Because at the end of the day, you know, we don't just want to talk about the problems that we face. I feel like we spend a lot of time talking about the challenges. Everybody watching this channel is trying to figure out, okay, how do I then take this information and learn what to invest in? And so we do want to start highlighting solutions when we feel there are ones that are credible enough to be worthy of your consideration. All right, so moving on from gold, guys, in the remaining time we have here, I just want to dial through a couple of key points that were made by our faculty at the recent Wealthion conference, and love to get your guys' feedback on it. So let's start with the keynote, which was Lacey Hunt, former Federal Reserve senior economist, highly successful bond investor. Lacey has long banged the drum that deflation is the big problem that America and most other Western nations face. He said, yes, the Fed did have to shift its attention to fighting inflation, and it needs to keep it there until it gets inflation under control. But he feels that the Fed is going to win the inflation battle. Said that they always do. They know how to make it happen. Yes, it might be painful, but the Fed's going to win. And he said that, you know, once inflation's under control, we're going to have to go right back to fighting deflation again, except it's now even worse of a problem than it was before. The debts are bigger, the demographic issues are worse. And what he's sort of warning of is we may get to a point in the not too distant future when deflation, you know, really steps into the driver's seat again, becomes a big enough concern that it does force the Fed to start having to respond with, you know, big stimulus packages. And he said the big tell, his big concern is that those aren't going to work like they used to. You're going to get diminishing returns on Fed intervention. His specific comment was, it's going to be like the Fed is pushing on an increasingly loose string, right? It's just going to, you know, take out its fire hose, its bazooka, and you're going to see less and less effect from that. So maybe, John, we'll start with you, but I'm curious, as Lacey was giving all of that, you know, what was your interpretation and as a capital manager, what does it make, what questions does it start raising in your mind?
Yeah, Lacey was a fabulous speaker at your conference on Saturday, Adam. I encourage folks to, if they hadn't participated, I think you have options for them to access your conference. It's a wonderful packed day of varied speakers, and Lacey was one of the most memorable. He's a very wise man, and he speaks very thoughtfully with data and charts to back it up. And his presentation was chock full of a bunch of those charts. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think he made a very good case for why that, you know, even though right now the fight still should be on inflation. I don't think he was saying that battle's done yet, but that it will get won and the tide will change towards the other side of the equation.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt, but just to throw an analogy in here, it's kind of like being on a sinking ship and the cabin you're in suddenly catches on fire, right? Like you got to stop what you're doing for a second, get the fire extinguisher, fight the fire and put it out. But when it's out, you're still in a sinking ship and drowning is still your bigger Right.
That's a really good analogy. I think it's quite fitting. I think he pretty much, you know, described that kind of scenario. So as a capital manager, there's certain assets that do well in an inflationary environment. And we certainly have an allocation to those. We talked about gold mining and our, leaning towards real tangible assets, whether they're held with us or outside through real estate or other physical gold or whatever. But there are other assets that do well in a deflationary environment. So things like longer-term bonds end up starting to be a very good place to be. What doesn't do well are the things that require economic growth, and things like stocks, broadly speaking, especially because they're still at massively high valuations. Even in a non-deflationary environment, it's hard to come up with a fundamental justification for stocks making much progress over the next decade. In fact, it probably our base case for the next decade is probably looking very similar to like the late 60s to early 80s, where the market went literally nowhere, lost value on an inflation-adjusted basis, but there were massive swings along the way. And an approach that tries to just ride a tailwind, like many approaches did over the last 40 years, into the next 10 to 20 years, we think is likely going to be very disappointing. We think a more tactical, a more pivoting kind of approach, not to use a word that's been used ad nauseum as relates to monetary policy, but we think there's likely to be these dramatic shifts between regimes and policy responses. To go with those on probably an increasing frequency, we probably will see a number of turns over the next decade, not one consistent policy that has markets levitating in one unilateral direction like they did for much of the last decade. The bottom line is we think there will be opportunities regardless of the cycle between inflation and deflation, but those opportunities are likely going to be ones that require a tactical, adaptive approach to capture and rotate out of as new regimes start to take place in the inflation deflation kind of cycle.
Great, yeah, and I will say that pretty much, every speaker's presentation in one way, shape, or form sort of underscored this, success strategy of more active investment going forward. That the era of passive investing that the world is still so used to and is so desperate to get back to, where we can just buy the sector ETFs and just ride everything and buy the dip whenever it happens and make money year after year after year, that's over. And you're really going to need to be much more nimble, much more diligent in terms of coming up with your investment thesis and then monitoring everything to make sure that your thesis is still holding true. And if not, get out of it quickly. These are the things that a financial advisor, it's a big, huge chunk of the value that a good financial advisor is bringing to people in the type of environment that we're entering here. Mike, I want to come over to you. I'm going to blend a couple of people's comments and sort of riff off of what John was just talking about there. So one of the people that had one of the more kind of dire outlooks was Stephanie Pomboy, who comes on this channel a fair amount. And she was saying that she anticipates what we're headed for, potentially as early as later this year, is like a 2008 style crisis, like a real credit crunch. And she, was warning us about how quickly you can go from inflation to deflation, kind of building off of what Lacey was saying. She has some stats back from the global financial crisis, where just over the span of two quarters or so, we went from pretty hot inflation, 5%-ish CPI to negative 2%. Just warning that, hey, don't think it can't happen, because it there's definitely evidence it's happened before that we were all worried about how high the CPI was, and all of a sudden we're all worried about deflation on our doorstep. But she talked about the lag effects, right? Remember when we were talking about that from Jerome Powell, not talking about them in his presentation. She definitely believes they are a massive force to be watching. And I've been saying on this channel, you know, it's going to be sort of like these shockwaves that keep hitting the economy again and again and again over the next couple of quarters. She thinks it's actually going to be more, rather than like a repetition of body blows, it's more like a stubborn bottle of ketchup, where, you know, each lag effect hitting is a tap on the bottom of the ketchup bottle, tap, 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 and then blorp. It just comes out, you know, all at once, ruins your meal, right? Sort of the everything everywhere all at once crisis, right? You know, related to that, when Michael Pinto was talking about, you know, how he's navigating this market, he's got this 20-point model that, you know, takes all these different factors into account and is saying, hey, it's actually now really beginning to blink red enough that he is starting to go out duration on treasuries. He's been sitting a lot in short-term U.S. treasuries. It's now saying, okay, now it's time to go out longer on the duration curve. And John, you just mentioned that earlier, but also said it's time for him to really start adding shorts. So to the concerns that John raised and then what I've just mentioned from Stephanie and Michael there, Mike, again, sort of as a capital manager, curious, A, how you reacted to that, but B, what does that make you think about what you need to do in terms of preserving capital and then hopefully growing it in this type of environment if there are opportunities to?
Well, I love your analogy about the ketchup bottle. Remember that back in the day, you know, back in when I was a kid, there were all these glass bottles and you had to stick the knife in there to get the ketchup out. And you know, the squeeze bottles were a great invention. Those are wonderful. I'll just say that.
Hey, sorry to interrupt, but this is a random piece of trivia, but I hope enough people will like it that it's worth the interruption. If you remember the old Heinz glass ketchup bottle, right around the neck of the bottle are these little raised 57s, right? Which are part of the brand, right? That's got 57 varieties of spices, I think, or something like that in the ketchup. But if you hold one of those bottles and it's stuck like that, the ketchup doesn't want to come out. If you tap it there right on those 57s, that's the pressure point that releases the vacuum inside the ketchup bottle and it actually comes out. So if you ever see a glass bottle again and it's stuck, hit that 57, it actually magically does work.
That's pretty cool. I never knew that. It just reminds me of being like in a diner and, you know, trying to get them on your home for a ketchup on your home fries or something. And I will definitely remember that. That's pretty neat. Great analogy. Yeah, when you've got a system, like I said earlier, that's this pushed to its limits by every record you can imagine, then accidents tend to happen. Accidents tend to happen to the downside. I try not to sound too extreme, but it's quite a possibility that 2008 was just a warm up. That was 15 years ago. It's hard to imagine. It's hard to admit that 15 years ago, and we all look silly warning for years too early in some cases that this system was going to break, that this was not sustainable. Who would have imagined the amount of money that the world central banks could print and how long it would last? You know, but the signs have been appearing in larger and larger cases over the last 15 months since the top in January or December, January 22, December 21, depending upon which index you look at, the cracks have been appearing more and more regularly. And it's just a large top, a boring top, if you will. I mean, I hear some people say, well, last year was a plunge. It wasn't a plunge. The market wasn't even down 20%. It was hardly a bear market at all. And in my opinion, it's a high likelihood that we're just getting started. I would say that listening to all the people on Saturday at the great conference that you hosted, Adam, the common message was this: the Fed's never going to stop printing, probably overall, but no matter what they do, we're pretty concerned about where we are economically and in the market. And so there is precedent for the market continuing to ease the Fed continuing to ease and the market still plunges. That's what happened during the financial crisis. So don't sit around waiting for the Fed to pivot. I know that it's impossible to not talk about the Fed most of the time these days because they do control the day-to-day gyrations of the market. But the big picture is becoming clearer. Gold seems to be breaking out to the upside. The S&P 500 is in this big 15 months kind of feathering or fanning out top over the last 15 months. And we could easily have an accident or a big fast move to the downside, like Steph says, like the ketchup coming out of the bottle. I think that later we would look at that and say, oh, well, gee, all the signs were there. Why didn't we see them? Well, a few people did see them, but in the day-to-day movements, it's impossible to fight the crowd. But if you push enough buttons or push too many variables to the max in any given system, every engineer knows this, system becomes less stable. And so I really do expect that Steph is likely right. Nobody knows the exact timing on this. You know, Fred Hickey, who just had on, was also very bearish. I think that he said something more about the October timeframe. In my opinion, it's definitely this year. I've been wrong before, but I won't be wrong forever. And all the signs are definitely showing there. So I'd say be cautious.
All right. And be cautious was, again, a universal theme from pretty much every folks we had, you know, person we had there, which is now is not the time to strive and speculate for gain. It's really a time to sort of batten down the hatches, preserve capital, and then, you know, make sure you kind of make it through the storm to where the sun comes out again. And then, you know, maybe you'll have some great opportunities, hopefully, to deploy that capital at much better valuations. You mentioned, you know, don't place your hopes on a pivot. That's something we've echoed a lot in many of the recent videos here, because the point that we've made is, if the Fed is forced to pivot, you know, Powell seems to be, you know, very committed to getting inflation down, as he should be, and is telling the market, look, I'm not going to pivot. I'm not going to pivot, right? And, you know, and of course, we all think, well, there's something that's going to force him to pivot. Well, if there is, it's likely to be something so terrible that it is not going to be bearish. It's not going to be a bearish environment, a bullish environment for stocks. It's actually going to be quite bearish. So I totally agree with your point there, Mike, which is, you know, don't be pinning your hopes sort of as a general equity investor on the Fed, you know, starting to cut rates and then the market magically melts up again. That said, there are a few asset classes that I do think you want to be in before a potential Fed pivot. Moving out long on the quality bond duration curve, I think makes sense. And we had Michael Leibowitz speak at the conference, who was basically saying that he thinks that we're kind of at the peak in yields, you know, right about now, and that right now bonds, in his terms, are a steal, and that this really is the time to lock in bond yields, which he says we may not see again. And we got a little bit joking about this, but might not see again in our lifetimes, depending upon how old we are. Now, not saying with a guarantee that that's going to indeed be the case, but you want to be in those, you want to have your positions and your exposure there before a Fed pivot is announced, because when one is announced, that asset will probably move quite quickly. And if you're not already in it, you may miss it. Similarly, on the precious metals side, one of the asset classes that would likely respond to the announcement of a Fed pivot positively would be the precious metals space. And so I presume you would want to have your exposure there in advance too. And so again, probably for both those two asset classes, if you don't have a position or have too little of one, you probably want to be, you know, adding to it, dollar cost averaging your way in. That's my presumption. But Mike, I'm curious, do you agree with that, or do you have a different opinion?
I completely agree. I don't think you're going to have time to put your position on when the news comes out. This market is discounting what's happening next. I mean, there's a reason why, if you look at the 10-year, I was just looking at the chart of the 10-year bond, it's at 3.4, you know, and the six-month treasury bill is 4.5, 4.6. The 10-year note's 3.4. You know, we think that long-term bond yields are going even lower. Particularly if we see a big drop in the S&P, that we think that investors will scramble to lock in decent longer term yields. You're not really going to be able to get into this position later, and you're not going to be able to get into it at the right time. So I would tell people to nibble on high quality long-term bonds, maybe 10%, maybe 15%. A barbell strategy makes sense. Really keep most of your cash in short-term, high-quality treasury bills that you could sell quickly or that mature quickly so you can do something else with it. Buy stocks, spend it on something else, invest in real estate. if we see a correction in real estate, but start nibbling on the long end, 10 to 15%. You can buy the 10-year treasury bond. You can buy one of the exchange traded funds that own long-term high quality treasury bonds. Some people choose to really go super long-term in duration by buying zero coupon bonds. That's fine too. Those will probably do well too. I don't really see any need to do that. If you bought one of the ETFs that owns long-term quality bonds, you at least get to get a coupon interest payment while you wait. So if you're early, you at least make some income. So I would just start that position here. I don't think there's going to be time to do it later. And the same goes for gold. Gold is seeming to be breaking out again. There's been some head fakes before. I strongly believe that one of these will not be a head fake and that we'll see some real movement. John pointed out on the chart earlier how gold mining stocks are lagging so far. They could play catch up pretty quickly. So don't bet too much, but start these positions. Add a little bit more if the price moves against you a little bit. And you might even add a little bit more if the price moves in your direction. So it's all about just taking some action and don't get frozen. Don't place too much in a position that'll make you feel panic. I just think these moves will likely happen quickly.
Okay, great. Well, John, look, as we begin wrapping up here, I just want to get your parting comments on the remarks made by housing analyst Nick Jerley and auto trader Lucky Lopez, who both delivered, you know, kind of pretty pessimistic outlooks for their respective areas of expertise. Nick basically said, hey, look, he's been talking for a while now about the coming housing market correction. He's saying, yeah, it's not coming anymore. It's here. It's unfolding. He went through some great charts. But the first one he put up there was showing that there's a number of major metros that are now down, over 20% since May in terms of price, not transaction volume, but actual median price. So, he basically said, look, he sees us going into a housing correction, a housing bust, and they typically tend to be measured in years. He did think that this one was going to be a little bit more unique in the sense that the majority of the decline in this one, he thinks, is going to happen in the first year, meaning 2023. So there's that backdrop of a pretty strong housing market correction. And then Lucky Lopez was talking about what's going on in the auto market, where how incredibly distorted prices got for a whole variety of reasons during the pandemic. And now because a ton of bad loans had been made, that there's going to be a real kind of reckoning amongst the auto industry in terms of, tightening credit standards, because so many bad loans were made that it's just going to get, there's demand for cars is now going down, and people's ability to qualify for loans to get a car is now going down because of those tightening standards. So he sees both kind of like a winter arriving for all the companies in that space. But for the consumer, he says, hey, look, if you're in the market for a car, you're probably going to find much more affordable cars at the end of the year. So anyways, with that twin backdrop, curious, any parting advice you have?
Yeah, well, those are two goods or things that people need, right? People need transportation, most people, and they need shelter. These are not discretionary items. So when those things start to fracture, start to show cracks like they are, that's really, I think, a real important warning bell for the broader economy, because that speaks to a really overextended consumer. It speaks to a contraction. There's a little bit of a lesson to be had by these bank runs. Bank runs, even though they start with legitimate fears, the real damage is often done by the psychological stampede in response to those fears. And that stampede oftentimes becomes larger than is truly warranted, perhaps by the initial concerns. And that's that same thing kind of is what creates bubbles in stocks, houses, cars, you name it. It's that stampede in into the things that and the prices that result from that become untetheredly high to the underlying reality of where they should be, and that's, I think, what we're starting to see. We're starting to see the the pendulum swinging the other way in housing and cars, and we think it's going to follow through more meaningfully into the stock market. These are important things that speak to a broader syndrome of issues that have manifested that are starting to matter all at once.
All right. Well, gents, thanks for giving me so much time today. Several other notes that we're going to have to save till next time. But great commentary. And as we wrap up here, first off, whatever happens in the markets from here, we'll have you guys back on again next week to really dive into, what's happening in terms of the market action. We focused mostly on the Fed this week because that's tends to be what precipitates market action. But folks, whatever happens from here, we'll be reviewing it with these guys next week and helping you understand, what it all means and where it's likely headed from there. Couple quick housekeeping notes. One, we've talked a lot about the conference from this past weekend. If you weren't able to watch the conference and are feeling regret over that, don't worry. You can actually still watch the conference. We recorded the whole thing, so you can get replays of all the presentations as well as all of the Q&A with the speakers, plus the transcript to the live community chat throughout the whole day, which was really active. I love how valuable that or how much value that adds to the experience. It's sort of the hive mind of the hundreds of people watching, sharing ideas, reacting to comments that the speaker said, sharing particular investment opportunities that are related to the key points being made, debating macro issues. It's really one of the most valuable parts of the conference, I think. So you get that as well, plus links to a number of the different resources that were mentioned by the faculty there. So if you want to go get that replay, just go to wealthion.com/conference and you can purchase it there. In wrapping up here, I just want to reiterate my regular advice that most people, myself included, in an uncertain market environment like this should be working under the guidance of a professional financial advisor who understands the macro issues that we've talked about in this video. John, Mike, and I, and of course, the great faculty from the conference that we've been referencing. If you have a good one who can create a financial plan for you that takes into account all those issues and then can work by your side to actively execute on it in the way that John was talking about, great, stick with them. But if you don't, or if you'd like a second opinion of one who does, perhaps even John and Mike and their team there at New Harbor, then we highly recommend you schedule a free personal consultation with the financial advisors that Wealthion endorses. To do that, just go to wealthion.com, fill out the short form there. It doesn't cost you anything. There's no commitment to work with these guys. They just offer it as a public service to help people make better informed decisions about how to build their wealth. All right. And wrapping up here, John and Mike, thanks so much for hanging with me for yet another week. Look forward to seeing you guys next week. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Thank you, Adam. We appreciate it. We'll see you next week.
Always a pleasure, Adam. We'll see you soon.
If you'd like to schedule a consultation with one of the financial advisors at New Harbor Financial, simply go to wealthion.com. These consultations are completely free and there are no strings attached. The good folks at New Harbor will simply answer any questions you have about your investment goals or your portfolio and give you their best advice given their latest market outlook. They're willing to do this because they care about protecting people's wealth. And because Wealthion has connected them with so many thoughtful investors just like you over the past decade. We started doing this because so many people have approached us in frustration, looking for a solution because they're feeling out of alignment or downright ridiculed by the standard financial advisors who have been managing their money. You know the type. The kind that just pushes all of your money into the market, scoffs at the idea of owning gold, and when you bring up concerns about the market's sky-high valuations, they say, "Don't worry. The market will always take care of you." For many of the reasons discussed in today's video, we think this is one of the most challenging and treacherous times in history for investing. We strongly believe that today's investors are best served working in partnership with a conscientious professional financial advisor who understands the risks in play. Now, we're agnostic which professional advisor you work with, as long as they're good. If you're already working with one, that's fantastic. Stick with them. But if you don't, or are having trouble finding one you respect or trust, then consider talking to John and Mike and the team at New Harbor. Now, for those about to ask, yes, there's a business relationship between Wealthion and New Harbor, which we've put in place to make sure everything is handled according to SEC regulations. All the details on this are clearly provided on the wealthion.com website. Also, it's important to note that New Harbor is able to work with U.S. citizens, green card holders, and those with existing assets in the USA. But for regulatory reasons, they aren't able to take on non-U.S. clients. All right, with all that said, if you'd like some insight and guidance on how to protect your wealth during this unprecedented time in the markets, go to wealthion.com to schedule your free consultation with the good folks at New Harbor. Thanks for watching.